Founders, welcome back to the Zero to 5,000 podcast, where we obsess over the convergence of human potential and business results. Today, our hosts Drew McClure and Jordan Mitchell have another insightful conversation for you. So let's jump right in.
Okay, founders, welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm joined by Brock Berry. Brock is a highly accomplished senior executive, C-suite officer, entrepreneur, consultant, and board member, boasting over 20 years of experience in marketing, advertising, and technology. He co-founded AdCelerant, a leading digital advertising company that achieved over 4,000% growth in its first 4 years, reaching revenue milestones exceeding $100 million. Brock's vast experience includes leadership roles at notable firms such as Affinity Express, Ad Taxi, and Digital First Media, where he demonstrated proficiency in strategy, integrated media, and technology solutions. His contributions have earned recognition from industry publications and awards, cementing his reputation as a top professional in the field. And today we get to hear from Brock himself and the journey that he's been on. And so welcome to the show, Brock. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Drew. This is it's a great introduction. I don't even think of myself the way you just described it, but I love it.
And that's how it typically goes. Most successful people I know, when they actually hear what they've done and accomplished, there's a little bit of, really, is that me?
Exactly. So
you're not alone in that. So catch us up a little bit. We kind of read, you know, the brief highlights of your career so far and your journey with AdCelerant, but how did this whole thing get started?
You know, there's several things. Like, I feel like most entrepreneurs might feel this way, but for me, there were a lot of different things that sort of led me to start this journey. The first one was at a bar in Ireland, where my eventual business partner was telling me about a company that he had owned before Google, was a search engine called Go Kaboom. And he was telling me how amazing and easy and incredible his lifestyle was as an entrepreneur. And I was like, wow, I mean, I work all the time. Like, it would be great if I didn't have to work so hard. And I thought, at that time, I thought that's what being an entrepreneur would be like. I will cut to the chase. That is not really what it's like at all. You know, so that conversation got my brain going, I guess, as it relates to this. And then eventually, as I was working with John Chamberlain, that's the person I was speaking of there, and also my wife and coworker at the time, Shelby Carlson, we realized there was a gap in local marketing where a lot of small business owners are just not being given the types of marketing solutions that they need to be competitive with, you know, Madison Avenue level marketers, you know, companies that are working with Omnicom and some of the greatest agencies in the world. There's just not a level playing field for Verizon versus the small retailer in Denver, Colorado, or whatever community you hail from. So for us, we saw that as a huge opportunity. Most people don't want to serve those customers. I thought I'd be, you know, working less and enjoying life a little bit more outside of work based on John's story in Ireland. But in fact, you know, we set out on a mission to kind of bring Madison Avenue level marketing solutions to Main Street businesses. That's not at all what happened. For the last 10 years, I probably worked more than I ever have. But I also love what I do. And it's been a really fun and fulfilling and successful journey that I wouldn't trade anything for.
Yeah. Do you think it's helpful or unhelpful not knowing the reality before you get into it? Like, do we need that naive optimism sometimes, or would it have been better to have braced yourself a little bit for the reality of the journey?
I think it's better to start off knowing what you're getting yourself into.
Okay.
You don't want to be disappointed, I think, that early on. And I kind of know myself well enough to know that even if it were an easier role and an easier lifestyle for me from work perspective, I probably still would have put as much energy and enthusiasm into it, because it's just kind of natural for me.
Yeah.
But it's starting, being an entrepreneur is a really difficult and challenging experience. And if you're up for it, you know, the reward is there, but it comes with a lot of risk.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, I think one of the traps that social media has, whether intended or unintendedly, given us is that there's such thing as like a really great payoff with a really easy road. And I hear it every day on social media, like, for no money, no time, you could be a millionaire tomorrow. And I'm like, Where else in life do you see that being the case, that something really awesome was on the other side of something really easy, right?
Exactly.
It just doesn't work.
No, I think for me, it was the my version of that when we started this 10 years ago, is I'd sit there and I'd read Inc. magazine and Entrepreneur magazine, and I would see, you know, so-and-so entrepreneur started a company, was given all this money by, you know, private equity or something, and now they're worth $1 billion, and they're just, you know, they're just living, right? Things are amazing.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my version of what you just described. It seems so easy when you read the story in the magazine, and then you go do it and you're like, it is nothing like the story I read in that magazine. It's not even close.
So what was, I like to always break it down to like either year one or year one and two, depending on whether it was the same chapter or not, but like, what was the actual reality of the first year of the business?
I think this is one lesson that anybody considering starting a company really needs to know going in, so they can be prepared and, you know, for whatever it's worth, be ready for some of the challenges that they're going to ultimately face. For us, you know, we didn't really pay ourselves for the first 2.5 years of the company's existence. And that was not paying ourselves in growing from three founders to probably close to 30 team members before we really had a meaningful paycheck. Now, I put that out there because, you know, when you're starting a company, especially today in today's age, and you're, most companies are not being given a bunch of money by angel, private equity, or otherwise, they're starting off with just, you know, what they had in their pockets before they started, and maybe some money they can borrow from a family member. But it's, that is kind of the, I think, more typical challenge for an entrepreneur. You know, for us, it was really difficult. We mortgaged our house. We had a rental property, which we sold and used the cash from that. We sold all of our cars. We borrowed some money from my stepmom or my mother-in-law. And then, you know, ultimately, before we even paid ourselves, we were really on the verge of complete bankruptcy. Personally, you know, the business was doing pretty well, but we were doing very poorly personally.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a really tough part of this journey, but it made us, you know, gave us some grit and helped us keep our priorities in line. And I think because we sacrificed, though, it allowed us to really propel ourselves forward. And I think sacrifice is one of the most important things that anybody who's starting a company needs to know, is that without sacrifice, there won't be gains. And for us, we made huge sacrifices. I remember driving my brother-in-law's minivan around for the first like year or two of this business, because I could borrow it from him. He didn't need it. And it was the only thing I had to get me from point A to point B. And trust me, that was a very humiliating, very, very, you know, challenging time in my life where I was like, I can't believe this is where I'm at now. You know?
Yes. Yes, man. Those are all the moments you don't expect, especially emotionally. You know, I can still remember starting my business in the first few years, how much anxiety I felt going to fill up my car with gas. And I just didn't expect that. Like, I'm pursuing this dream. It's going to be awesome. And I'm like, I think I can get a full tank, you know? You just have these kind of humbling moments. But to me, it sounds like the advice you're giving, which I think is great, is, do you have a realistic runway, right? It's going to take some time to get this plane off the ground. And the biggest hurdle might be self-induced, which is, I didn't give myself a long enough or figure out how to get in a long enough runway for this thing to even take off.
Yeah. And for those people who don't give themselves a long enough runway, what I think happens, and it's kind of a mixture of both, like having a long enough runway, but also once you have funds to pay yourself, not getting greedy too fast, or not getting greedy, period. You know, because for us, even though we had made that huge sacrifice, by the time we started paying ourselves, you know, we were really some of the lowest paid people in the entire company for the next 12 months, at least.
Wow.
You know, and by maybe month 15 after we started paying ourselves, we were in the middle of the pack. You know, in month 24, maybe we were finally making more than everybody else. But it was, you know, for the first 4 years or more, we were either not getting paid or getting paid less than at least, you know, at least one or more people that worked there, because we knew that although we were sacrificing maybe a paycheck a little bit on our paychecks, by sacrificing that, we were able to make investments in other parts of the business that allowed us to scale. And I think that's a dilemma that a lot of entrepreneurs face, is that once they have the funds and the cash flow to be able to pay themselves, they want to start, you know, realizing the benefit of their hard work. And that's super understandable. But if that benefit is at the sacrifice of something that the business needs, then you're going to hinder your long-term growth. You're going to stunt your growth.
Yeah.
You know, for us, we made those sacrifices for the first 4+ years. So by the time we were in year 5, we were flying. And you can see that in our growth trajectory and the numbers and everything else.
That's amazing. Making sure that you're not robbing, you know, the future of the business because of the present want, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's a life lesson and principle across the board, you know? But I'm so curious. Like I've interviewed multiple, you know, kind of marketing agencies, ad agencies. I've worked with some. I'm an executive coach outside of a podcast. The level that you guys have scaled this to is thin air. So I'm just super curious how you did that.
You know, there's not a single thing that you can point to that answers that question, but there's certainly, you know, 3 or 4 kind of categories of things that will answer that. You know, for us, we've had tremendous success scaling this business. I mean, today, for context, we have nearly 200 team members, and we're doing, you know, north of nine-figure revenue on an annualized basis. And the success of the business has a lot to do with probably 3 or 4 very specific kind of pillars. You know, number one, and this was one of our primary objectives when we started the company, is we were going to put our people first. Our team was always going to be number one. So when we made our team number one, meaning whether it's, you know, having the right benefits, paying them correctly, you know, managing and leading by example, you know, all the things that create good culture within a company, those were always our top priorities from the first day we started. It was just the 3 of us. But by doing that, you know, what you have is you create a really good work environment. And those people that are super happy and excited to come to work, they are the people talking to your customers. And your customer's like, wow, man, this person's excited to talk to me. And they know a lot about what's going on. They obviously love their job. It must be a great company. And that kind of enthusiasm then is infectious with your customers. And the customers are excited about what you're doing too. And then they're going to spend more money. You know, and when the customer then is happy and they're our second priority, if you will, behind the team, it ultimately produces the right revenue and growth and profit and cash flow the company needs to continue to reinvest in itself. So that for us was always number one, putting our team first. And then the second thing was, once you kind of created that waterfall dynamic between your team to your customer to your profits, it's making sure that we're taking those profits and constantly trying to reinvest in the business. You know, so for us, that meant building a platform. We've developed a platform called UI.marketing, which, you know, effectively automates or greatly simplifies the media planning or sales process in local marketing, fulfillment, all the execution, and reporting. It does, UI.marketing is kind of a turnkey agency solution for really anybody. I mean, any individual can become a digital agency with our platform. It really turns everything that's super complex in digital advertising into a very simple single sign-on sort of solution. So that investment, even though it's terrifying and we made tremendously expensive errors over the life of the last 10 years, every time we did it, though, we just never gave up, right? We continued to pour money back into that part of what we were doing, knowing that technology is the future of what we were going to do and also the only way that we could scale.
Yeah, I'm just curious, what percent, roughly, like what percent of current revenue would you say is coming just from that tech platform?
So all of the revenue of the entire business now hinges off of that platform.
Okay.
So there really isn't anything that we do that doesn't have to involve UI.marketing. Now, there's obviously software fees and things like that as well, but those fees are really kind of our subscription fees are probably less than 5%. So it's not a part of what we're, you know, we're not relying on it to run the business. A lot of it is just the campaigns that the platform ultimately supports. We run about, you know, north of 10,000 campaigns a month right now as a company.
Wow. Amazing. So it's not that it became a product in of itself that was a huge revenue driver. It just increased the value, efficiency, and of how you are currently already serving your customers.
Exactly. Exactly. Cool. It also separated us from our competition. And I think, you know, as you think about maybe the final piece of what allowed us to be successful is just always focusing on the fundamentals of business that kind of give you a durable competitive advantage. You know, for us, those were simple things like, you know, really managing the margins of the business, right? You've got to make sure that you can, one, set up a gross margin percentage or a financial position within how you execute your business that is consistent, steady, and durable. You know, I think that's one of the greatest value drivers in business today is that if you can kind of maintain that percentage on a really consistent basis and it's healthy, that is that's a sign that you can stand the test of time. You know, So for us, like these kind of fundamentals became our primary focus after we've taken care of those first two things. Beyond that are things like customer concentration. Like when we first started the business, you know, in the first few years, we had two customers that made up like 93% of our revenue. So every time I ran that report, all I could think was, is if one of these guys leaves,
we're screwed
not business anymore.
you know?
So today we're happy to report that our largest customer is only about 6% of our total revenue. That's a really, really good thing for us from a health perspective. It means that even in the toughest times with some really strong headwinds, that we'll be able to kind of, you know, navigate through whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
You know, so the fundamentals, and I could go on.
How long did that take? How long did that take to shift from such a heavy concentration to a few to feeling like it was at least more healthily distributed?
We were able to get to the point where only one customer was 10% of revenue within the first 6 years.
Okay.
And then getting them to their low single digits has taken the last 4 years. And it's just a really heavy focus on business development and healthy growth and, you know, the right targeting and things like that in terms of the types of customer acquisition we're focused on. So those things, they ultimately can become self-fulfilling if you're focused on the fundamentals, I guess.
Yeah. I'm always curious with someone that's had, you know, zero to 100, 200 million in revenue, if you haven't, that's totally fine. But if you see different like sections of that journey, like there was one lesson that, or, you know, the key to scaling from a million to 10 million was kind of similar. And then from 10 to 50 was kind of similar. Do you see any of that, or has it all just been kind of incremental, slow lessons applied over time across the board?
There's nothing seismic, you know, as it relates to that question. There wasn't a specific moment where it was a seismic shift for the business. I think what allowed us to do that, and this to me, I would imagine is a more common journey for entrepreneurs, is at least on an annual basis, you go through all those fundamental metrics that you should be tracking really closely, whether it's, you know, employee costs as a percentage of revenue, your gross margins, customer concentration, LTV over CAC, like you name it, there's dozens and dozens of these metrics, but looking at them minimum on an annual basis. And in the beginning, and this is where there's maybe larger shifts, at least from an entrepreneur perspective, in the beginning, it's probably you and maybe a few other people that sit there and analyze this data. And then you ask yourselves, what can we do over the next 12 months to get a 2% improvement on this?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not 25%, just a small, tiny gain that can be maintained forever. And what are your plans to do that? And then making sure you're executing those. And as you continue to do that year in, year out, eventually you'll find that the results are huge.
Yeah.
Right? It's just tiny tweaks over a long period of time and never giving up on making them a priority. Because I think as soon as you stop focusing on them, if you don't measure it, it won't happen.
Yeah.
Really what it comes down to. And the big benefit for us ultimately became, we didn't have to do all the thinking. We had a great leadership team. We developed them over a period of time. And then we took the things that we use, the lenses that we use to manage the business, and we trained them on how to use them themselves. And then we would push them and prepare them to create plans that would have the same kind of results that we would have had we done it ourselves. And to me, that is maybe a bigger seismic shift, is when you don't have to do it all yourself and you can actually have a team help you do it. But no, I'd say it's more small tweaks and consistent execution over a long period of time.
Well, you said something really key there, which is something that we could easily sustain. That
yes.
We didn't reach so hard to get that increase, 5% increase, but we didn't ever figure out how to do that in a sustainable way versus this is just the new way we do it. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And what's cool today, like, I think it's like an advantage and disadvantage in today's marketplace. AI is bringing in a whole new level of potential efficiency for companies. And, so maybe you can target larger percentages that are a little more sustainable because AI is truly revolutionizing so many facets of what we do as companies.
Yeah.
At the same time, if you don't have what it takes, whether it be know-how or funds or otherwise that you think is potentially necessary for you to have it integrated into what you do, then you're at a serious disadvantage. You've got to be able to take this stuff today, and it must be integrated into your plan, into your products, into the way you execute, or somebody else will. And it's going to be so much easier for whoever your customer is that you're going to have a hard time winning, So it's a really cool, tough time and a crazy dynamic that AI is bringing to the table.
Yeah. I'm actually curious because you hear talking heads, who aren't actually doing, in creative work and that type of stuff. Some are saying this is going to be the greatest companion to creative types. And others are saying this is going to be the greatest competition to creative types. In reality, at this point, I know the future is undetermined, but in the reality at this point, how do you see it? Do you see it more as a companion or more as a competitor?
I see it more as a companion, and it really depends on the kind of work that you're doing. So for example, if you use an AI to create an image or a logo or something that you want to copyright, you cannot copyright it if it's generated by AI.
It
must be created by a person for you to do that. So there's certain things where aspects of what comes along with creative where you must have a person do the work, right? This is why I'd say it's kind of more of a companion. But there's also a lot of things that happen in creative that you don't really need a person to do it. If it's not necessary for it to be copywritten, if it's not necessary for you to trademark it, then, why not let AI help you get a 10x efficiency out of a team member? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I've seen just brainstorming and first drafts. Those are the first two things that, like, AI has been an unbelievable companion for me. I hate first drafts. Sometimes it's just so hard to get the initial structure and ideas down, and just to be able to input, hey, can you please create this sales email for me that has this information as a rough draft? Then I can come back and put our language in it and tweak it. I've seen that be amazing. And then also just brainstorming, hey, can you give me 12 good ideas for this type of content or for a title to this type of blog post or whatever? And I'm like, oh, it just gets your brain firing, from the jump. I'm like, that's an amazing companion to the creative process.
It really is. And I think that's why every company in 2024, if you don't have an AI strategy or an AI team task force, if you will, you need to start today. Like, that just must be a must thing to do right now.
Do you already have resources dedicated to that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a huge part of what we're doing, and we're kind of uniquely positioned for this because AI today is generative. So it requires information basically to be useful.
Yeah.
We've got 10 years worth of campaign data and results and performance information and things like that, you know, can greatly, you know, broken up by category and, you know, fill in the blank of the nuance of how the data can ultimately be, you know, dissected. But yeah, we're in a really fun position for AI. And I look forward to kind of some of the tools that we're going to be able to release in the next year.
Super cool. So yeah, are you able to take just a whole bunch of data like that on any given category and actually get some insights out of it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
We've got it where it'll give us insights into, you know, if we're running 10,000 campaigns, you know, it's pretty hard to know if somebody's upset, right? Because how do you know? There's tens of thousands of tickets basically running through our order management system. So if an AI can go through all the tickets in the matter of seconds and say, wow, here are five tickets where you have customer frustration and here's the sentiment, like that is earth-shattering progression for us, right?
Yes.
We can way more quickly diagnose issues and address issues in real time.
Yeah.
So those are just some of the examples of how we're using it today to solve our own problems and hopefully in the short term, long term, solve our customers' problems.
Did you have to figure out how to create that function, that AI function yourself, or did it already exist somewhere and you were just able to take advantage of it?
You know, there's so many different tools, whether it's ChatGPT or otherwise, where you're taking an engine, if you will, and you're plugging it into a set of data and then training it on what you want from it. That's really what we're doing today. We're not building out our own AI product, if you will. We're definitely going to be using the pre-existing stuff that's out there on the market, whether it be Google or Microsoft or otherwise, and trying to make sure that what we're really doing is enhancing the job that we already do. Right. I don't want to reinvent the wheel. The wheel's already been created. And boy, if you wanted to even closely catch up, you just gotta join them. Right. There's no way you're going to build something brand new right now to catch up with the people that are already out there in front. So how does the stuff that's already out there in front enhance the work that we already do and make it better?
Yeah.
That's how we're focused on using AI today.
God, it's wild, man. I saw a TikTok the other day of a college student taking her exam. And she had one of those engines up in a little window on the side of her screen. And she would just screen copy the question from the test, copy and paste it over there. And it would spit out the answer and an explanation of the answer. I'm like, how do we, like in real time, how is a professor going to stop that or adjust to it? You know what I mean?
Yes.
That's wild. Cause you're already doing it on your laptop. And so you're able just to screenshot it, plug it in, and like in an instant, the answer. So she's not like taking an extra hour to do the test. She's probably finishing this faster than everybody else. And just has all the right answers.
You know, and we're just at the beginning here where you're starting to see some kind of multimodal AI where it's not just content, it's imagery, it's even
film creation.
Yep, exactly. And it's all done through single prompts. You know, that type of stuff is just the beginning of what's next. And I've read some pretty interesting stories talking about, you know, the eventual maybe 5-6 years out where some of these AIs can completely act independent of the people that work in the companies and fulfill all kinds of needs for the business. You know, they're talking about billion-dollar companies that may only have like 10 or 12 employees because they've got 100 AIs that are doing, you know, 1,000 people's work.
Yeah.
And that is not that far off. I do think in the next probably 5 to 7 years, you're going to start to see that level of application of AI-based tools.
Well, that's where it gets interesting, where I guess you could say it's a companion if you're the business owner. It's a competition if you're the employee, right? Seven years from now, if that future exists. Right now it's a companion to everybody, but I think that's where they're all guessing, right? But like, that's where it gets interesting. Like, does it actually take me out of my job?
You know, the thing is though, if you go back to where we started in this conversation, you know, we're trying to find these small incremental improvements and get greater efficiencies and just build on our whatever foundation we're starting on. The AI-based tools, when you get to that level of application, it's going to open up doors for entrepreneurs. Like your podcast is an example.
Right.
It may be infinitely more valuable in 5 to 7 years because the average person who maybe did lose their job due to one of these applications, but now they can start a company and do things that would have taken us, you know, 10 years to develop 10 years ago that they can develop in the matter of months.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, there's also a lot of benefits, I guess is the point, that should allow, I think, entrepreneurship to perhaps have the greatest time in history, perhaps, next 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, that's been the argument I've heard that's made the most sense, which is everybody freaked out when horses were obsolete because the poop cleaners had no job and the people doing the shoes on the horses had no job, but cars created jobs. And it was like, it opened up as many opportunities as it closed down or more. And you just pivoted into the next opportunity.
That's it. I think I genuinely believe that's where it's going. You know, what does that mean for each one of us individually? It's hard to say.
God, one of the things I've thought about, and maybe if I put some time into it, I could figure it out. It might already exist, but I'm like, I've done over 300 interviews like this with people like you. If I could, and I have all the recordings, they're online, they're on Spotify, they're on iTunes. Like, could I throw that into an AI engine and just ask it some questions? Like, aggregate how many people answered this question this way, or give me the top lessons learned over 300 episodes. You know what I mean? I'd just be curious, like the data that I couldn't do. I can't go back through all of those and quantify it and qualify it, but maybe AI could take the wisdom of 300 conversations and do something with it. You know,
I was at a AI and journalism summit in February in Austin, and one of the publishing companies showed a really cool AI application that they had developed where it had the data from over 100 years of stories that they had written as a company. And they were prepping for another story about the 4th of July parade. And they were entering the name of the person who's the grand marshal. And the AI spit back a fact to the journalist that said, the grand marshal for the 4th of July parade has been someone from this family for the last 100 years.
Wow.
Right. And it's like,
they had no idea.
Would have never known that. Right. But it looked at the database of all the stories and it matches up that person with all the previous people who had done it. And they're like, it was a fact we could have never found on our own. So it's out there.
What it's making me think of is the impact feels similar to Ancestry.com or 23andMe.
There you go.
Like, I already have friends right now that just found out their granddad was not their granddad because of this. Like,
that's crazy.
There's, you know what I mean? Like, there's interesting, both positive and like at least difficult things that are made available when you actually find out, is my dad my dad? You know, and then it's like, oh, this family secret gets shared when 23andMe comes back and says your siblings are your half siblings, right? It'd be the same thing, you know. It's just more transparency, more information, access to information is going to be super interesting. One of the things that, again, I want to just take advantage of the fact that you've scaled a company from just being a co-founder to over 200 employees. What is the difference, or some of the differences, in running the business when you had 30 employees versus running the business when you have 200?
That's a good question. I think for me, what I see today, that some of the biggest differences, and they kind of come along the way as well. You know, when you're a team of 30 as the CEO or a founder of the company, you're still doing a lot of the day-to-day work, you know, hands on keyboard doing work that ultimately you want to be able to delegate to your team. As you go from 30 and you start to get to numbers like 50, what happens is your hands aren't on the keyboard nearly as often. And what you really become is a coach and a mentor to your leadership team, mm-hmm. with a really huge focus on developing them to be able to do their job when there's 100 employees. Mm. And it's really critical. And we've had a lot of successes and plenty of years as it relates to this, where we've had leaders that are, you know, been in positions within this company for 7 years and they're still killing it. And we've had leaders that along the way, we couldn't develop them fast enough to keep up with the work that was going to ultimately be theirs. And they had to change positions or in some cases leave. So I think in, as you go from 30 to say 100, that becomes one of the bigger challenges is for yourself transitioning from doing to leading more. As you go from 100 to 200, it starts to become very unwieldy unless you've developed your leadership team in a pretty amazing way. Because obviously in the age of computers, we're talking about all this AI stuff, the most of your errors are going to come from people, right? And if you can't hold the people part of your business together at 200 employees, you're going to fall apart really fast. So, you know, as a leader of 200, you know, my time is spent more making sure I've got a great leadership team and that they're executing as we've designed in whatever that plan is for the year, for the 2 or 3 year plan that we have. And then hopefully finding some time to think about what are we going to do next? Right. Yeah. So that's kind of been the evolution of my role from 30 to 200.
I've seen that. That feels like a very familiar trajectory that a lot of businesses go through. You know, that I had to be in the business, I had to wear multiple hats to, hey, I think I need to empower some more people at this point and then keep scaling up from there. One thing I'm curious as well is I've seen a lot of heartache that some of the early people that worked really well when the team was small and 30 people and everything was organic and it was kind of like we're in a clubhouse together. When things get more mature and it's more organized and less organic and there's more systems and more whatever, some don't transition well. And that's really hard because they were your first loyal people, you know. Totally. Did you experience some of that as well?
We definitely have. And, you know, I've had varying degrees of success. You know, if you think about it on a scale, one being the person ultimately leaves, and that's the worst possible position you can be in, and 10, they ultimately graduate and just find their way forward in a new company.
Yeah,
we've had everything in that spectrum. You know, when you lose that person, and I've had some really interesting moments where, you know, somebody who's one of our very first team members, ultimately around probably a team size of maybe 120, in a super senior position, handling a department of almost 50. You know, he came to me and he said, I'm, you know, I'm going to leave. I'm resigning. I can't continue to do this. Mm. And, I said, you can't resign because, you know, you've got all this equity and if you resign, you're going to forfeit this equity and eventually it's going to be worth something. I said, let me come back to you. And in cases like this, we try to do this as much as possible because we love the people that we work with. We found a different role for him, moved him into it. And he stuck around, and it was definitely, I think, you know, I'm really proud of him because he, you know, it was an ego hit for him to go from a super senior level title to a pretty mid-level position, but he did it and he crushed it in his new position and he was way happier personally.
Sure.
Wasn't, you know, to your point, like it was more familiar with what he remembered when we started versus where he was at by the time he needed to make that change.
Yeah.
Man,
that's what's cool, so over the board. That's what's just so fascinating to me is like if the person has enough trust with you to talk, there's a variety of things that could be going on. And sometimes it just needs to go somewhere else. Like I've found that some people thrive better in an early stage startup and their skills are better there. And this is just not that anymore. And so maybe let's go help you find another early stage startup, right? But sometimes like that person, I see it in like sales where someone is like a killer salesperson and they think the way to promote them is to then become the sales director and they're no longer selling and they're managing salespeople and they hate it. And like some of them find a lot of freedom in just getting back into the sales seat. Like even if it's a title hit, like, let me just go back to where I feel most comfortable using my skills, you know?
Absolutely. I have like a lot of respect too. We have a lot of folks that have been here for 8 or 9 years that they've been in a very similar position from the first day to where they're at today. And I'll check in with them. Cause obviously at this point I know them really well. I'm like, how's it going? They're like, oh, it's great. You loving your work still? They're like, oh yeah, man. Because I don't ever want to do anything else. This is what I want to do. I'm good at it. I don't have to rely on anybody else. I can come and get my work done, go home and not have it hang on me. Like I have a huge amount of respect for those people because that level of like satisfaction and just being able to enjoy where you're at, what you have, that's a tough thing for most people to have.
Yeah,
you
know? Contentment. We're always Contentment striving is hard. For
that. Exactly. Contentment. It's such a hard thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, that's so cool. I love that. Again, I admire those people. I'm like, I want to learn how to be a little more content and not always feel like you're reaching, grabbing, needing the next thing, right?
It is the infinite ladder complex. You know, mm-hmm. there's always another rung on that ladder. It literally goes on forever.
Yeah.
So if you can't find contentment, you're going to be discontent forever.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Last question. I know I've already had you here for a little while. I appreciate it. When you were, cause I know a lot of businesses, even that I work with, are at that like 30 to 50, employee range. And they're seeing right. like, you're right. I really need to build that core leadership around me. Mm-hmm. What, when you think back to that time, what did you, and maybe your co-founder or whoever was doing this, what did you see was the most effective? Like, how did you go about actually developing? Some are like, I sent them to trainings. Others where I spent a lot of one-on-one time. What were the things that you say, this actually moved the needle? This helped us get the result we were looking for.
I think for me, the thing that I find is one of the most useful ways to develop and scale our company is by developing very specific processes and habits and structure around functional parts of what we do. And you can even do that for a leadership team. So, you know, examples maybe around that size would have been, you know, making sure that everybody had a pretty consistent way of managing one-on-ones and having very consistent subjects within those one-on-ones. Obviously, like there's aspects that are going to be unique to the individuals and to the roles and the departments and the work and things like that. And that stuff has to be organic and it needs to be in there as well. But having consistent discussions around like the individual's career, what they want in their jobs, like what's making them happy, what's not making them happy. And then making sure that that manager knows that it's their responsibility to respond to that, right? And have a plan, answer. And if they don't have an answer, to come talk to me or whoever it is that makes the most sense to be able to develop that plan. That's one piece is kind of, you know, structurally as it relates to their day-to-day work with their teams is making sure that we've created a process for them to follow that should help them organically grow as a leader. Then you think about the more sophisticated aspects of being an executive. Those are things like managing budgets, managing P&Ls, putting together budgets, strategy, you know, that type of stuff we were still going to be very involved with no matter what. But we also had a really specific process for defining those things. So if it was a budget process, you know, I might have done it myself in the very beginning. By that point, that size of company, we had a template, we had directions within the template of what they needed to look at and do. We would pass that off to them. They would go work on it. And then usually, you know, if it was somebody's first time doing that work, what they brought forward is probably not what I wanted, you know, but instead of, you know, trashing them or beating up on them for not having the right answer, I was like, all right, cool. Let's review it. And you give them all the feedback and say, all right, go back and do it again. And they come back and the next time it's probably halfway there. But if you do that, you iterate enough with them in each facet of what probably made you successful as an entrepreneur and make sure that you're creating a structure and a repeatable process with them where they have to do it too. And not everybody's going to be able to meet your expectations and be able to stick and stay in the roles that you need them to be in. And that's when the job outgrows them, sadly. But for those that can, you know, you're going to see it. You're going to see them replicating and creating work that's either as good, if not better, than what you would have done yourself. And to me, it's just that repetition and consistency with our management team and pushing them to their boundaries, to their limits as often as I possibly can without, you know, putting them in a bad spot. That's been critical.
Dude, that's huge. Yes. I see that all the time. I think one, again, I see it this way. I've always referred to it like there's the organic phase of the business. And that was necessary. Like we needed that flexibility. We needed that experimentation and freedom. And then there's the organized part where it's like, hey, we actually need this not being everybody doing it their own way. Right. There's room for that still, but there's certain core things that we all need to have in common that actually accelerates the learning. Like if I delegate something to you, there's about 20% of the personalities that if I said, hey, here's the goal, go figure it out, do it your own way. 20% of the personality be fine with it. They'd be like, got it. love it, off to the races. The other 80% are going to be so paralyzed by the lack of structure you've given them that the best thing you can do is hand them a process and just do this. Do exactly how I said to do it, when I said to do it, the way I said to do it. And then the learning is going to come in what you talked about, which is when they tried to do it and it didn't work. Yeah. That's coaching. You're like, cool. Okay. I saw you tried this, but really what I meant was this, you know, and then you're actually learning. And for a lot of people I found, if they've been doing the role a long time and now they're trying to pass it off, all that they've done is gone into the subconscious. They do it without thinking. And it takes a little time to go, how do I do this? Right. Did you ever have some of that where you're like, how do I teach this? I do it every day, but I've never thought about how I would explain it or put it in a process format, even though I'm doing it in a processed way, right?
Totally. That's a challenge, I think, for a lot of people. I think in the form of process. So to me, it's like it's how I maintain some level of sanity with everything that's going on, is everything has to be super organized and very structured. And as long as it's like that, then I can remain calm at all times. But if it's, you know, it's when it's not that I start to get anxious, you know, so for me, it's always just kind of how I work, but like, it's a fact. I mean, I think people maybe ask me in sales trainings, like, you know, what's your thoughts on a needs assessment? It's like, I don't know. I don't have a process for that. I just do that. You know, that's just how I work. But it's, you're right.
But the cool part is if you were to sit down with it and you were to say like, no, how did I first learn this? What goes through my mind when I'm in the needs assessment part? Like some like frameworks would start to come out. That's the exciting part is, I mean, the first time I coached soccer, I played soccer my whole life. And then I coached, I was so overwhelmed that I couldn't remember, how did I learn this? Like, I can't even like, how did I approach this? How did we learn this strategy of the game? But if I sat there long enough and just spent a little time, hey, can I remember any drills that were important? Can I remember the first time this lesson happened? Same with teaching my kids to swim. Same with teaching them to ride a bike, you know, driving a car. All of those are now on the automatic where you're like, I just do it. My hands are 10 and 2. I check my mirrors. I know which way the thing is. But when you sit there for a little bit, that information comes back up to the surface and you're like, start here. You know, here's where we can start. So super cool, man. I mean, anytime a business survives, it's a win. Anytime a business survives and grows to the scale that yours has, it's truly something to learn from. So I'm really appreciative of you being here, sharing your story and your wisdom. And it's clear, and having talked to you for an hour, it's clear why you all have been successful. Really, that's really, really nice. Well done. So Brock, thank you for being here. And I hope you come back sometime. I'd love to talk to you more.
Absolutely. Nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Founders, thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast and hop into our monthly founder email so we can ensure you stay on the edge of peak performance and massive business results.